just get started.
Yeah.
Well, it's really great to have Yuri in the department. He's going to educate us and inform us about the goings-on in the data center.
Yeah, so the data center is an accident. Way back when I was still at Berkeley, my thesis advisor, Leon Henkin, inspired me to work on educational things, and it became addicting. And I ended up with a center that I think is the third largest organized research unit at the University of Texas, with 70 employees, another 100 in a public-private venture we built. And it appears that we're going to double in size in the next 3 years. When I first came here, there was a small group of faculty, Ephraim, John Dollard, Mike Starbird a little bit, few people who were interested in these issues, and we worked on undergraduate education, emerging scholars, trying to improve freshman instruction. And then in 1994, I made the mistake of being in my office and picking up the phone. And it was the governor. Just before, it was the last period of Ann Richards' governorship. And she said she needs someone in the math department to work on writing the mathematics standards for and science standards for the state of Texas. And I should have claimed that Professor Treisman was in New York giving a lecture or something or other. But I ended up volunteering. I was the vice chair of her governor's volunteer commission at the time, so she actually knew she could count on me to do it. And it got our department and the university involved in a complex process of visiting 90% of the more than 1,000 districts, holding regional meetings, spending a lot of time in Texas schools, trying to understand what opportunities students had to actually to do mathematics. And one of the things that was startling is it turned out there were a lot of kids who really liked mathematics, and they were routinely running out of mathematics to do. So it struck me that we as a math department should be doing a few things that were relatively easy for us to do and that would serve the population that cared about our discipline. And we started proposing ideas like guaranteeing that every student who loved mathematics would never run out of mathematics to do because of the accident of where they lived, right? And we started constructing special projects around this nature. But because of the standards writing work, the legislature liked that work. It was extremely difficult politically to help people come to some agreement about what students should learn in school. People had remarkably strong opinions about this. And because we were able to do a respectful job of listening and protecting good mathematics, the legislature appointed the Dana Center, this little ORU in the math department, as the State Center for Educator Development in Mathematics and in Science. And that led to millions of dollars of grants, about $10 million in grants, to bring award-winning teachers, presidential awardee mathematics and science teachers to the center, award-winning superintendents and deputy superintendents, and to build a support system for districts that wanted to improve mathematics first with a little bit of work in science as well. Since then, the place has grown, and my idea is to talk about four little projects. But before I do that, I thought I would just give you some perspective about what's going on in math education internationally, nationally, in our state, and in local districts. What's the context of this? And it's important, not for this audience, but if we have a moral responsibility as scholars, it's to instill doubt in people who are too sure. Right? And math education is full of mythology, and people seem to believe in this discipline that the plural of anecdote is data. So I thought it would be useful just to show you what's actually known about this, and then how the work of the Dana Center fits in. The Dana Center is very unusual because most math departments have 10 or 15 people who like to work with teachers, who do special projects in the local community. We are very lucky to have people working on UTeach here, which has gotten a lot of legitimate national praise. But the Dana Center is unique in that we work at scale with large systems. We almost never work on projects that involve less than 1,000 teachers or 10,000 students. So our specialty is working on the undignified blue-collar structural engineering work of improving systems so that the accident of where kids live plays less of a role in what kind of opportunities they have to study. That's the hope of it. One of the hardest parts about doing public work of this type, working with governors, working on the President's Council of Advisors of Science and Technology, is suppressing your strongly held feelings about the work and balancing my strong feelings about what good mathematics is with something that I believe the public can actually get behind incrementally to improve its systems. This takes a lot of emotional strength, and I think I grow tumors on some occasions when learning to suppress my feelings in some of these meetings, especially the ones involving our State Department of Education, where they do things like remove Thomas Jefferson from the history standards and replace him with Phyllis Schlafly and people of that sort, as required people to be studied in state tests. So just one little anecdote of the wandering mathematician setting standards. I'm in East Texas, the Piney Woods, showing them the math standards for the state of Texas that we're proposing. And one gentleman points out that you have the volume of a pyramid there. That can't be right because pyramids can't have constant volumes. And I'm trying to channel my mother and say, more words, please. And he says, when the angels are in the pyramids, they have to be heavier. Doesn't that mean they have more volume? And it requires the ability to get out of your world and try to figure out what the world is that the people we're trying to serve is, and how to build systems so that their children have an opportunity to engage things that benefit us all.
Who was this guy?
He was a school board member east of Tyler, Texas. Yeah. So, okay, there's a general perception that the U.S. is somewhere near Rwanda in international comparisons of mathematics. Most Americans believe we're near the bottom of the world. And what's interesting is that some countries try to emphasize their strengths. The U.S. historically has depended on crises to motivate improvement. So we're addicted to Sputnik-like events. So the newspapers and politicians routinely claim, I think there are 15 states that claim to be 49th in education performance. Right? We're addicted to underestimating our achievement. But that's very dangerous because it sends a message to teachers and education leaders that there are limits to what we can actually do. So what is the actual data on U.S. performance? There are two different instruments for measuring it, and both are beautiful instruments, very nice statistical sampling, very thoughtful processes for instrumentation and setting of standards. And the first is the TIMSS. And the U.S. is one of the few countries that's getting noticeably better in the rankings. In fact, there are only five countries that now statistically outperform the U.S. and statistically outperform it by decreasing margins. The high-performing Asian countries, Singapore being at the top, Hong Kong, South Korea, right, do much better than our students, somewhat better. 1999, we were in the middle of the pack. The fact is there's been an enormous amount of energy that's been put into improving math performance in the U.S., but almost all of it has been focused on bringing up the bottom and eliminating innumeracy, and almost none of it has been focused on nurturing students with a deep love or talent in mathematics. There's no national policy that supports that end of the spectrum, which is extremely short-sighted in my view. But we have done things that relate to the social justice agenda of making sure that people are not totally illiterate and innumerate. And we've made big gains on that side. So a lot of people will say, why don't we just copy Singapore? Well, it turns out that systems are very complex and you can't just pick little pieces out of A and put them in B. And it turns out that several states in the last international comparisons agreed to be oversampled so they met the standards for participating as a country. You gentlemen, I am sure, are aware that it's usually Texas, our state, that thinks of itself as a separate country. Right? But in this time, Massachusetts and Minnesota agreed to participate. And they did as well as Japan, as well as Taipei, in the ballpark pretty close to Singapore in the fourth grade, and better than any European country. A full standard deviation ahead of Norway, which means that our 8th grader, our 15-year-olds, are outperforming Norway's 17-year-olds in performance. No papers covered this at all. This got zero press coverage. Right? So we actually do pretty well. So the question is, why copy Singapore? It's easier to copy Massachusetts. And since I sit on the International Benchmarking Committee for these exams, I get to visit these countries. And you can see that there are many dimensions in which they're different culturally, but they do have certain characteristics which are in common across cultures. They all have a very high bar for entering the teaching profession. In Finland, they actively recruit. Finland is the highest performer, actually, on the other international comparison. Singapore, South Korea, aggressively recruit the strongest college graduates and make it extremely difficult to get positions in teaching. And of course, that can't not help but matter. In the eighth grade, we do slightly worse, but we're still ahead of any European country in Massachusetts and Minnesota. And the data shows that white Texans now do as well as Japan as a country. If we just restricted Texas to white students, which some politicians probably would like to do, in fact, white kids in Texas do pretty well. Using some basic statistical techniques, the National Center for Educational Statistics, I'm a teacher, I recognize this side sucks, too much information. You think of it as an operatic prop for the moment. Red is Texas. On these international tests, when you look at the Texas sample, Texas also outperforms. There's no European country that outperforms Texas. And we do fairly well compared to pretty much anyone. We outperform England, Australia, Germany, Denmark. And that's a big surprise to people until you actually go to these countries and go visit their schools. There's a lot of talk about Japan being way on top. I worked 3 tours for the State Department, for the Japanese government, helping them with their collapsed schools, of schools in trouble. So I got to see a fuller perspective. And when you're actually in place, you get to see that this is actually pretty real. Now we go to PISA, the other test. This is a test of 15-year-olds, 30 countries, and the U.S. does very poorly on this. So you might ask, how could it, and probably are asking, how could it be that the U.S. is near the bottom on PISA but near the top on TIMSS? And the answer is they test very different things. TIMSS is a test of what you learn in school mathematics. It looks like a state achievement test, or it looks like the SAT. You can actually get released items online. They're multiple choice. Big emphasis on computational routines, which obviously are critical if you're ever going to do mathematics. TIMSS tests the ability to use what you learn in school in unfamiliar situations. Right? It's basic math. Can you use basic mathematics? Can you see opportunities to use basic mathematics through early high school math in real-world settings and figure out how to do modeling and actually use it? Why do we do badly? Because we don't teach that in our schools. That's not what's been emphasized. Until now, as I'll mention, the change is coming afoot. This is very profound. 12 years ago in Japan, they had similar results. They were about the middle of the pack on PISA and the top on TIMSS. So as a country, because they have a national system, they made a decision, let's balance our assessments and our curriculum between use and skill. Obviously, if you're going to be a good user of mathematics, you need to have be really proficient automaticity and skills, and you really need to have some conceptual understanding and practice in using mathematics in the world around you.
So the scale, the scale score, I don't know what it means.
Yes.
Much more compressed than on the TIMSS data.
Yes.
So
Yes, so this is a very good point. About 100 points is a standard deviation. A quarter of a standard deviation is about a year of learning. So this is the way the graph is drawn is not helpful. That is, we're about three quarters of a standard deviation behind Finland on this test. So it's quite significant. But it's often missed. It's a good point. Many of these countries are clumped together, and rankings, like rankings of math departments, aren't particularly helpful to understanding quality, except when you look in the large at big differences. Good point. But this is about three quarters of a standard deviation difference, which is actually very significant. One of the things about American performance that the Dana Center works on is variations across states. The green here is statistically above national average on the nation's report card. Beautiful instrument, National Center for Educational Statistics, very large sampling program. We have very good data on performance across states, balanced by rural, suburban, urban, and so on. What's very interesting, so this is proficient. Proficient on NAEP was set by conservative politicians who were interested in showing that no Americans were proficient. And in 1990, when this was first started, only about 4% of American students were proficient by that measure. It was actually set that way by the politicians who set it up. We've had dramatic increases in students who are proficient in 20 years. And what we, in 30 years, 20 years from the 1990 test. And what we see for white students is, except for Massachusetts, Texas is the highest proportion of white students who are proficient. California, which is the only state of our size and complexity, is way behind. And there's actually about half a standard deviation difference in average performance of white students. It's about two grade levels. And we've actually checked this and calibrated it with qualitative studies. There are big substantive differences. That's true for black students. Even though black students in Texas are significantly poorer than black students in California, many more students in Texas are proficient, about one-sixth. And the same is true for Hispanics. And actually, Texas outperforms Massachusetts, which is the highest outperforming state in aggregate, when you break it down in subgroups. It's just that we have more poor people and more students of color, that we serve less well. So Texas has had much more success than people recognize. And the reason, which was one of the first things the Dana Center was involved in constructing the accountability system, was because of this weird innovation that became national policy. And that innovation was, when schools are rated in Texas, they're not rated on their average performance. Each subgroup is broken out, and the lowest subgroup's performance determines your school rating. That obviously has many weaknesses to it, but it has one big strength. It drives up a performance from the bottom. It does nothing for the top. The holy grail is building a policy system that increases growth at all levels of interest and talent. And we have been focused almost exclusively on raising the bottom, which we have done. This was Ross Perot's idea before he went crazy. Put together a group of businessmen who basically wrote the rules on this. When you look at cities, the differences are stunning. Fourth graders in Houston perform as well as sixth graders in Cleveland and L.A. Austin is way up there. And when you break it down to smaller subpopulations, you could see that these state differences really hold up at every grain size you look at. As I'll say in a few minutes, the Dana Center has built a network of the heads of mathematics in all of these cities. We just convened them last week. We've had 24 urban district heads, more than half of all the urban kids in the country. And when you convene these district leaders and look at the results of student work, it roughly mirrors what you see in these national tests. And when you collect homeworks and you do random samples of homeworks and class assignments, kids have very different opportunities to learn. largely, your opportunity to learn is an accident of where you live and what school you're in and which teachers you get assigned. And one of the challenges is to try to balance that out. It'll always be the case that advantaged parents will do everything they can and should do everything they can to benefit their children. The policy challenge is how we increase the likelihood that people without those supports get a chance to actually do good mathematics, right? Read decent literature and not just tell stories about what they did on their summer vacation, right? That's the fundamental challenge of improving math and education policy. One of the most startling things, I know this slide is small, is that in 40 years, the educational gap between the top 10% and bottom 10% in income has doubled, and the average gap between blacks and whites has halved. So we've actually made significant progress on racial gaps. We're not done, obviously, right? We've made significant progress, but wow, are the gaps by income really growing. And for the first time, we have lower rates of upward social and economic mobility than most European countries. That's terrifying, because the American democratic tradition is built on the idea that through hard work and education, your children can have a better life. And when we have decreasing number of people moving up the social ladder, it threatens part of the social contract that underlies our country's democratic structures. So, what does the Dana Center do? First, let me just say that most people who look at international, state, or district comparisons tend to focus on one thing at a time. If we only had better math books, if we only had better teachers, if we used project-based learning versus lecture, all of these, this is sort of like looking at the effect of individual vitamins. We have people who believe in vitamin B6 as the cure for everything, and they're advocates for vitamin B6, and others work on vitamin D. In fact, this is a multidimensional problem, right? And many things have to happen to improve and even understand performance in systems. And there are four dimensions. This is the part of me that teaches in the School of Public Affairs, sort of the standard rubric for understanding performance in these systems. Policies matter enormously. How much money goes to schools, how teachers are certified, how schools are evaluated. Those policies really do shape what adults focus on in these schools and what they can focus on. The structures they have in their states for actually helping teachers teach, right, and helping parents understand their options are profoundly important. Agency, their capacity to actually execute within these structures, matters enormously. And the culture, what they really value, matters enormously. Finland is interesting in that Finland was a low performer 20 years ago. And they made a national decision about redesigning their education system, and one of their first values was equity. So 1/7 of all the teachers in Finland are explicitly trained to focus on achievement gaps when they occur and prevent kids from falling behind. It's completely different than our system. So when you look at the Finnish data, they not only have the highest performance, they have the lowest variation. Even when you restrict it, compare it to coherent, homogeneous subpopulations of other countries, right? Their national priorities were embedded in their culture, which are reflected in their policy structures and ultimately their capacities. So the Dana Center has projects that work on all of these, and I'm going to give you a 30,000-foot view of four of them, which always terrifies me because I am not a manager. I have a deep love and respect for it. And I've inherited this thing with now hundreds of people and 10,000 teachers and so and so. And I'm hoping that some of you might be interested at a certain point in your careers, if you're interested in education, in rolling up your sleeves and being foolish enough to help lead some of this work. Plenty of opportunity for people who want to climb in. So the Dana Center. Organized research unit, 70 people with 100 additional people, probably 50 consultants who make their much of their living connected to this work, so it's over 200 people. The dark green are the states in which we're working with 1,000-plus teachers, tens of thousands of students, and you'll see what that work is in a few minutes. The light green is where we have substantive engagements in districts at scale, but not the whole state. And the others, we have periodic working with teachers here and there who use our online services, consulting arrangements, developing things for states, and so on. So the first project has to do with community college mathematics. Upward mobility is really important to the Dana Center. And our mission is to do things that increase upward social and economic mobility that connect to mathematics. So in community colleges today, more than half of students start their college education in community colleges. And as college costs go up, increasing numbers of low-income people have no option but to start in community college, no matter what their backgrounds. Most students, 55% in just start in high school algebra, intermediate algebra, arithmetic. Only 6% of the enrollment is in calculus in that whole sector. About 4% of the people who start in arithmetic ever make it through college algebra. And at San Diego City, where I did a major project, I had asked for the data on all the students who started at the beginning and finished differential equations over 3 years. And her name is Rosa Martinez. I'm not kidding. I went in ready to use my statistical prowess and all the modeling courses I teach at the LBJ School in this. And when you can name the student, you know it's a different order of problem, right? Didn't need to use high-powered statistical techniques, right? It's a disaster, a burial ground. There's a national movement to redesign these courses. And what they are basically the 1950s high school curriculum that got enshrined in these courses when these institutions were built. Most of their faculty at that time were high school teachers. These were spin-offs of public education. And they wanted to make sure that these kids had a full high school education. Now there are thousands of people who want to be policemen, firemen, EMTs, LVNs, interior designers, who are stuck in reaching their career goals by college algebra, where they actually probably would be benefit more from is statistics or a basic mathematics modeling course. It's a criminal, just to be blunt. MAA, SIAM, ASA, AMATIC have come out and made strong statements about this. AMS, not so. They're still concerned about the effects of enrollment. But this is a major issue. The Dana Center with the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching convened the 17 organizations of mathematicians, developed a set of outcomes for new courses to replace these old high school courses. And basically the idea is to set back and figure out what is the evidence standard for what we require of people who are not going into mathematics-intensive professions. And the Bureau of Labor data suggests, as I said, that there are whole subsets of them who would be better served by a good statistics course that reinforced basic numeracy principles. And there are others who would benefit from having a course in middle school and high school mathematics apply to problems in the real world. We are in the midst of forming an arrangement with the 50 presidents of Texas community colleges and the state legislature to work on replacing this vestigial system. And we're working now in 8 states to redesign these math pathways, especially for non-STEM-oriented students. It's also clear that the STEM pipeline is broken. Recent data in California shows that 60% of blacks and Hispanics fail college algebra. And just one little piece of data chart. What is this little beast? In Florida, like Texas, for many years, all students, when they start community college, have to take a placement test. It's offered by the College Board. It's called ACCUPLACER, until this year when they changed it. There's a state cutoff of 60%, which I marked at 0. If you get lower than 60, by law, you have to go into developmental math. You go back to algebra or intermediate algebra. If you get 61, you go into college algebra. So this is 3 years of data, tens of thousands of students, complete this set. It's not a sample. Right? You would figure that students who are close are pretty similar if they're 1 point off. This is stupid policy making, right? let one point have high-stakes consequences. This is an example of innumeracy, by the way, in public policy. You would figure, though, that if students had the benefit of a developmental or support program, those just to the left, when they took college algebra, would actually do better than those who are one to the right because they had the advantage of a prep course. In fact, they don't. They don't in Texas, Ohio, or California, where we also have complete data sets. So this developmental program is actually dangerous. But of course, what's interesting is what happens to students with perfect scores. And only about 44% of them actually complete college algebra. So this is a situation where even students who are told that they have a perfect score, more than half of them are withdrawing Q, W, or F for college algebra. This is a disaster. So much of the public discussion is about replacing the developmental courses. The danger is that we build a six-lane highway into a swamp. Right, so the Dana Center is leading state efforts in several states to redesign these pathways. And this is really important work for us because you have no idea how many people know us because they failed a stupid college algebra course. When they really, if they had an experience that was more about mathematics rather than isolated techniques, it would do us collectively good as a profession. College algebra is a strange course. In some states, it's high school.
Just what would be one of the topics?
Rationalizing binomial surdenominators, factoring trinomials.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. In some states, they still have rules. Descartes' rule of signs is in the course. So you have people who want to be interior designers. In order to get their certificate, have to take a course in playing or use the Descartes' rule of signs. Right, to say something about the roots of polynomial functions. I do not think it would take us more than 20 minutes to come up with a set of more useful mathematical topics for those people to tackle that reflected, that had mathematical integrity and reflected more the spirit of what mathematical work is. But in these fields, history weighs like a mountain on the present. And these are old agreements, and it's connected to people's jobs. Two-thirds of all the faculty who teach in these institutions are contingent workers. They're not tenured. They're piecemeal. They work by course. So these are very hard structural problems of how you redesign these courses around the labor force that they actually have. This is the kind of work the Dana Center is engaged in. And our new plan that we're putting in involves the stat way, which we think of as building a stat way to heaven, quant way and a stem way, and these are accelerated one-year courses to move people through good mathematics into a whole array of careers, professions determined by certificates and licenses to replace college algebra, right, and older courses that are now in place. The danger is that when these students have their first successful math experience, it emboldens them to raise their aspirations. So the art of this is how do you build pathways that don't inadvertently limit people's options down the road? That's a high ethical responsibility for designers in this area. But right now the failure rates are so high that I think it's reasonable to do this kind of experimentation at scale rather than in pilot form. Last, in this little box, I know you can't read this, this is a small slice of a massive project we've undertaken with the Carnegie Foundation that involves convening leading American psychologists and social psychologists to map out almost minute by minute what are the problems that community college students actually experience. And if any of you are no economics, PICO economic theory of George Ainsley, hyperbolic discounting, we've actually have modeled the levels of engagement, commitment to learning of these students almost minute by minute in the first 3 weeks in a series of massive studies. And what we've learned is that more than 90% of students the day before they start are positive they'll succeed. They believe they're the ones who've chosen to advance through education. They are sure they'll succeed. The first homework assignment, they look at it, they want to do it, they really do. They have no idea what the hell to do. They don't know how to get unstuck. So they lower their estimate that they'll succeed slightly, and they hedge their bets. By the third week, they're working a few extra hours that are discretionary. By the fifth week, depending on who they are culturally, they're either there physically but not mentally, or they've disappeared. And we can predict within the first week who the Q's, W's, and F's are going to be. So there's this gigantic project to actually build advising and academic supports that are connected to a set of problems we know are there. Right now, almost all the interventions in higher ed are based on folklore. So this is a massive project. The Dana Center has its first faculty appointment in psychology, half appointment in psychology, with the guy who won this year's Paper of the Year, young PhD out of Stanford. And we have a team working on this problem. What is the evidentiary base for supporting student success in mathematics? Next, Common Core. I pointed out the PISA results. 46 states and the District of Columbia have agreed voluntarily to develop a common set of math standards, which you know all about. They are a balance between the PISA and TIMSS content. Is a mixture of strong skills development, which is critical, and strong conceptual development and application. The Dana Center won the contract to prototype the new national assessments to be used in 24 of those states in 2014. In other words, our center is actually going to define the meaning of the standards, because what's assessed actually determines the meaning of standards. So we are doing the evidence-based design modeling, the new psychometrics around this, and designing the new prototype items that will test a broader array of student skills. Very technical work. Really interesting work in how you surface, what the evidence is that certain assessments actually reflect student understanding and how you make that argument. So this is a big project of what constitutes good mathematical work. What kind of mathematical work do we want students engaged in? And a lot of this stems from work at the National Research Council on defining the dimensions of math proficiency. Let me just see if I can show you quickly what the new standards look like and why this is so challenging. Yes. Next. So the mathematics standards were modeled on Singapore, Japan, Korea, Finland. The team that put this together looked at the international standards, looked at Massachusetts and Minnesota, California and Texas, and made a complex political compromise about what should be learned at each grade level. What's revolutionary, and this really came from a very broad, a diverse group of mathematicians who were involved in setting these standards, is standards for mathematical practice. Stuff that was totally missing before. Attend to precision. Look for and make use of structure. Look for and make use of regularity and reasoning. None of this has ever appeared in standards before this, and these are the things that are going to be tested across the country. So this is going to require massive transformations in teacher education, because unless there are respectful support systems for teaching and learning this, like, this is the stuff we actually do in our lives here. Right? This is not the stuff that's been the content of school mathematics, let alone this. This gets all the publicity, but this is the core of the hard new stuff. So if you're interested in this stuff, we can show you what the new assessments, we can't publicly release them because these are, we have all kinds of people trying to figure out what they are. Right. But we can, as researchers, we can show you what these things are going to look like. Two other things. And then I'm just going to show you a little piece of the actual work, sort of a 6 or 7 minute snap of it. The network of support, one of the most important things we do is provide a coherent support system for the people responsible for mathematics in large urban districts. New York, L.A., Chicago, Boston, Atlanta, Seattle, Houston, Austin. Before we started this, the people in those districts did not know each other, and they would occasionally meet at professional meetings. We built a vendor-free environment in which they could surface problems they wanted to work on together. And we're pretty serious large-scale designers, so we build tools around the problems that emerge. The biggest focus in the beginning was comparing prices. At the first meeting, I was the senior advisor in New York and Chicago at that time to the chancellors for mathematics. And the head of math in New York and the head of math in Chicago, who had never met, are sitting down at their table. And they had both spent millions of dollars to buy a customized assessment package from Princeton Review. Chicago spent $3.5 million, New York spent $5 million on this assessment packet. And when they put them out, they were exactly the same product with different covers. So one of the things we've done is built a collaborative filtering system so that the people who run these districts can actually evaluate their vendors privately, compare prices, and collaborate to get better deals and have more of an influence on the products they purchase. Second was algebra is the burial ground. And it turned out in a survey of their teachers, the biggest problems that algebra teachers experience are not prior content deficiencies. That was third. The first is the perceived lack of student engagement in their algebra courses. And the second was the massive diversity of backgrounds, math backgrounds, that students bring to algebra. Teachers said it feels like students are 5 years apart in what they bring to the class, since they're all mainstreamed in these districts. So we built, for the first, we convened a National Research Council group of psychologists, child development experts, and we built a set of tools around engagement and goal setting for students that's spreading very quickly across the U.S. Kathy is a lead on that project. For the second one, we convened Jim Pellegrino, who's the leading learning scientist who led the NRC work in surveying what we know about human learning, together with Don Deschler, who's the leading American expert on children with special needs in mathematics. And we built integrated tool sets for teachers to help them deal with the complex diversity that they have. But last, most teachers for this new curriculum do not need little innovative projects or project-based learning. There's no place where that scales except in isolated schools. What they actually need is materials to support engaged mathematical work every day. If they have little units, it's fun for a week, but the next week it goes back to multiple choice, checking homework, and so on. So the Dana Center, 10 years ago now, formed a partnership with Linda Chappett, who was the president of Scientific American, developed Scientific American Library, and created Scientific American Medicine, and she developed the first online tools for certification of surgeons. And we partnered because what they have is so much better than what math teachers have. So we combined with her, we got a group of Silicon Valley engineers, Adele Goldberg, who developed object-oriented programming, and Dennis Allison, who's the D in Dr. Dobbs. And we spent a difficult year working day and night to put together a very sophisticated technology system that streams video at 28.8 so that we could work in the colonias, we could work in high-poverty areas. We now have about 500,000 high-poverty kids online, 10,000 teachers, with pretty sophisticated supports. And my good colleague, Kathy Cook, at the Dana Center, is going to just show you one thing we actually do so you can see what we're actually making available. And improving this is one of our primary objectives. Ephraim has been really helpful in this work.
See if your computer wakes back.
One of the things to introduce this, see if you can, is we discovered that most of the math folks who were helping these school districts were either developing teacher content knowledge or they were fascinated by a particular pedagogy, depending on what they were interested in. R.L. Moore-style stuff, project-based learning, use of clickers, Right. So it was very ad hoc, basically what people came across first. All of these are good things, but they're not a comprehensive product. What I was interested in was what's the evidence, quality evidence, for a task we give students to work on. If I give you a math problem, why did I think it's good? I was interested in knowing the probability that if you can do this task, what is the contingency matrix? What are the probabilities that you can do subsequent tasks that I believe depend on it? So we built a very sophisticated system that not only allows us to deliver high-quality instructional supports, but validate a very powerful analytics that actually allows us to see the potency of items as measured against later learning. Right? And that's, I think, a radical transformation, and you'll see some of it.
Okay. Thank you, Uri. So I lead the work at the Dana Center that is involved in creating and offering for these online course programs. I'm just going to show you a little taste, but let me try to give you a sense of the way we do this work. So we have developed course programs to support mathematics instruction in grade 6 up through 12th grade, including AP Calc and Stat. So we've built a vertical pathway. We talked about students being online, but the idea here was not to replace teachers, not to put kids in front of computers and have them doing self-paced instruction, but really to elevate the tools that teachers have at their disposal, while at the same time improving teachers' own knowledge about the mathematics they're trying to teach. So we really were trying to get at this double problem of helping kids meet higher standards and helping teachers learn what they needed to do to help that happen, if that makes sense. So, Uri and I thought you might be interested in taking just a little look at the Algebra 2 course material. So, just to give you a sense of how these are used, if I had a subscription to these materials in my school, I as teacher would be projecting the classroom room, which is I'm doing now. I would be facilitating instructional activities as I might normally, whole class discussion, small group work, individual work, but I have these tools to help me facilitate activities in a very different way. Students also have access 24/7, so they can go back and review, explore some of the interactions, do homework. There are assessments and practice problems here that students can do, and teachers receive real-time reports on how they did. So they can do on-the-fly diagnostics and really make some good instructional decisions as kids are in the moment of learning versus waiting 2 or 3 days. So what you see here is the Algebra 2 course. Every kid in Texas is required to take Algebra 2 for graduation. That's becoming a more national requirement now. In fact, in Texas, 4 years are required. So what do you do to make sure that kids have an Algebra 2 course that is accessible to every child, but yet rigorous enough that it's a real Algebra 2 course? That was the challenge for us. So what we've done here is built a course, as you see. You can see the focuses of the course, the foci of the course. You start with beyond linear, because in Algebra 1 kids are supposed to know very well linear, exponential, well, exposure to exponential, although that's changing with the Common Core. Really now the Common Core is saying kids need to understand the interplay between linear and exponential. And quadratic, but those are the three function families of Algebra 1. In Algebra 2, we say, well, you know that. Let's build on that and let's look at other function families. And so what you see here is a course that early on introduces students to the idea of inverse, so we can get at square root and logarithmic functions. We study exponential and logarithmic more deeply, square roots, quadratics, rational, bless you. And then we move into some of the tools that you can use. And we end the course with some work with conics.
Let's see how you do inverse functions.
Inverse functions? Okay. That was the one I wanted.
Perfect.
To do first.
There it is.
All right. I was going to show you rational functions, but that's okay. So the idea here, let me just minimize this a little bit. So remember, this is the first introduction, because what we wanted to do was say to students, you've studied functions before, but we want to talk a little bit more about why functions are useful. So you're looking at relationships between variables and what questions you can answer, right? So we start with presenting a scenario to students to bring them into this idea of why do we compare about inverses? So we have a situation where we have the classic speed and length of skid mark. And in this case, we're looking at safety investigators who are interested in this relationship. It's a clear question they might want to answer, and we ask students to explore it using as often as we can multiple representations, because we find that's one way that students can access the mathematics. So, you know, you see the classic table building, and you see this beautiful little, you know, typical graph. It's what you expected, right? But then we say, so, well, that's the way the safety investigators want to think about this. They're interested in, if they know the speed, can they predict the length of the skid mark? But
the police.
The police might have And so the question they might ask is, well, if I see the skid mark, how fast were you going, sir? And that's a case where we really want to think about a different way to look at those two variables. And so we talk to students about actually thinking about this dependency relationship in a different way. So yeah, we're going to get to the mechanics of, yes, we can talk about the domains and the ranges and the reversal of the roles, but we really want to get kids thinking about the relationship. And so we present this scenario, which is pretty engaging for them.
So each of these units starts with canonical images, often connected to characters who traverse different units. So there's a whole, we've gotten Department of Education NSF grants to study the psychological effect of visualizations on learning. So these are very carefully designed so that students come to associate a topic with two or three characteristic settings like this, and then they go and study them more deeply as they go into later. They come back to them and study them with increasing depth.
So you can see the rest. This is just the overview to get kids in, and then you can see the rest of this is very clearly about just introducing.
So, but in studying this thing about inverse functions, you study real value functions.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's useful.
We're very interested in. I'll tell you, one of the things this has given me is humility.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, half the problems that I was positive would work in predicting later success. There's nothing like looking at data every night. But this has a long way to... This is just out of diapers and into knee pants. I would love to have people interested critique this, beat the hell out of it, and make it better, because there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of poor kids using this every day. The better it is, the better we can...
That's right.
More service we can do.
So here's another, as Bruce said, another character that we bring to kids to say, okay, well... Another concept that you have to study in algebra 2 is that rational function. That's in the Texas standards. That's in the Common Core. Well, how do we make rational functions even interesting to most students? So we start with, a situation that speaks to their self-interest, which is about grades. I had students who fervently believed that they scored 3 out of 20 in the first quiz, they could still make an A in the course. So here we have a student who actually might be able to do that. And the way we're going to get at it is posing a scenario to students that say, well, if his grade is calculated as a percent of the total points, and we assume he never misses another question, what does he have to do to make an A? And we scaffold students here, because this is a nice application of students' numerical understandings of ratio. So we really scaffold a little bit for them, but then we get to the question of, well, can you generalize that? And then can you explore it graphically? And can you answer the question? We see here that 500 points will get him a 97, but what's the minimum? Because he doesn't want to do more than the minimum. There are a lot of students interested in that scenario. And we expect students to explore this with a graph and calculator, but we also provide a simulation so that after they've answered that question, we have an interaction where they can look at it and say, wow, huh. That's what that function looks like, at least part of it. And I can get here, and then we can have a big argument about whether it's 145 or 150 points, which then motivates the need in later topics for solving the equation. So I can see, well, am I rounding? Am I not rounding? Is it 90 points? Is it 89 and a half? But students are engaged in this, and they're hooked, and they want to know more about rational functions. And then we proceed to have them explore some other scenarios in which they're modeling with rational functions. We do mixture problems, inverse variation, but they're real world, they're context based, and then we move kids from that context into the more traditional ideas of rational functions.
So most American Algebra 2 books will do mixture problems or rate problems with numbers.
Right.
they never treat the general case, look at the functions arise, and never draw conclusions about the physical situation of mixing or rate. So what we've done here is take the classic problems and novel ones, use the algebra to create general solutions, and then study the form of the general solution as a way of gaining insight into the underlying setting. The problem is that the limit is not the kids. It is sometimes, but not always. It's usually the teacher's experience. And the question that's really, the thing that's nearly novel here, which he's opening up, is just-in-time, respectful support of teachers so they can privately see what are the mathematical issues, what are the common misunderstandings, what are the opinions of teachers they respect, so they don't have to make it up all alone on their own. And trying to build the evidentiary standards for what's better is what we're working on now. That's a very tricky problem. How do we know that an improvement is really an improvement? Right? Everyone wants to give teachers advice, but no one wants to tell them how sure they should be that they should take it. Right? So trying to develop surety and confidence measures in the advice is one of our big issues, research issues. That's it. You show them some of the teacher advice there?
I did just now.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
Yeah.
Let's look again. So we have two ways teachers can get this. They can go into it in the split screen down here. Let me show you the rational function. Pop it back. You don't like your computer. So we give them, so this is the rational function topic. So we give them topic level advice, and this is what I'm scrolling through down here. So this is what students will be able to do. It's classic goals and objectives. By the time they complete this topic on rational functions, they'll be able to do those things. And then we give them a planning tool, plan 9 45-minute days on this. This is a high school Algebra 2 class. This is a big topic in Algebra 2 in high school. And we talk about what each of the 45-minute blocks is going to focus on. We really try to orient teachers to what they're going to do there. We try to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously we highlight prerequisite skills. We talk about where kids are coming from in this topic, so we make sure teachers are aware of the fact that they're not coming to this totally as blank slates, which is a big mistake teachers make.
Right. They keep reteaching the same stuff over and over again.
And then we talk about the connections that teachers will be making in this topic. And then deliver instruction is the day-by-day. Here's how you facilitate a lesson. So that animation in the overview that I showed you with Terrence and his grade, actually walks them through.
So
this is the question. Teachers are supposed to give the kids the question, ask them, solve it before we do anything else.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
We have a lot of young teachers, first and second year teachers, with no support. There's very strong evidence based that a new teacher covers only 2/3 of the content they're supposed to cover because they can't manage the class environments. So one of the big value adds of this is it gives teachers, it increases the likelihood that kids will actually engage the whole curriculum. This is developed by presidential awardee teachers in the beginning, and then it turns out that those teachers speak a special language. And we've had to develop a system of getting representative, strong teachers in there to get an implementable set of recommendations that regular mortals could use. We made the mistake of choosing such amazing experts that everyone was admiring the advice and no one could actually implement it. So this is tricky. And trust me, we see all the problems with it. This is very hard to do when you get data. But if you're interested in instruction, you've played some role in this. Yeah, so you've seen it. My goal here, we have 500,000 kids online now, almost all very poor. More and more districts, San Antonio area districts, are using this instead of a textbook now. I've signed over all my intellectual property rights to the university for this, so we don't benefit personally from it. The money goes into a fund, we've set a public-private venture, a company that delivers the services at record low costs. The money we gets funneled back into the work, comes through the math department, in effect, and goes back into improving the products. So this is something we're proud of, but
it can always get better.
Yeah, it's going to double in size, and we have a lot of, you know, anxiety about, is the math good, you know. We make choices, like we're doing stuff on exponentiation, on logarithms. There's no literature on this. So we have our strong feelings about it, and then I meet with Dick Askey, who I respect, and other people who have strong feelings either. And it's very hard. There's no evidence base to decide whose strong feelings are right. So the idea here is to use an empirical engine to test these against what we think students should be able to do afterward. And that's only a partial solution. But at least we have some emerging evidence. And let me tell you, in education, it's a low bar for evidence. Yeah.
Is UT making money from this?
Yes. UT's gotten more than $1 million in royalties.
I mean, they're just passing on to...
From us. They get, because of the Regents' Rule, they get half of all the royalties. The college gets a quarter, and we get a quarter. So the university is more than $1 million in the last 2 or 3 years from this, and it goes into paying lawyers that we never see. It's infuriating. Because they're trying to become a professional organization with technology patents. We're one of the largest sources of revenue for the technology commercialization unit on UT. We don't get a penny of the money, though. Oh, and last.
No, you can talk.
So, teacher engagement. It turns out, we've interviewed thousands of kids in L.A., Chicago, New York. The typical ninth grader in L.A. does not know the name of the math course they'll be taking 2 years hence. That's not an exaggeration. They're like blindly being put through courses. They haven't even know what they are. Most of the students believe that you're born with math skill, and if you're not born with it, you can't do it. They don't get that it's a balance of talent and effort. The research shows pretty clearly it's a balance of talent and effort. So we found... based on the work of Carol Dweck and other researchers, Andy Elliott, that it's pretty easy to teach kids that you can get smarter by working harder, and that when you struggle, if you don't struggle, you're not learning. So we've developed a set of psychological interventions that help them make healthier attributions to their struggle. So if you're not struggling, you're not learning, and we have these ideas of productive struggle built into the lessons. And we show kids that when they're struggling, there's really brain activity going on, and they're developing pathways. And it turns out that kids actually pick up this, and it does affect their energy output. And we know this because the ethnographers who are studying this in Fremont, California, found kids saying, "Ain't no dendrites growing over there." So we solved one problem, but not another one. Yes.
What people are actually doing.
Yes.
So, for example, you would find out how many people actually read my papers.
Yes.
If we were there to look.
All nine of them, yes.
But so you have mounted the data from how students are actually using this, how far they're actually going, how fast the log is spent.
Yes. It's a gold mine.
Tell me something else you see.
So, first of all, just to manage the data. We started with Adele Goldberg and Dennis Allison. When you have 500,000 children using this every day, you can't go to the University of Texas. University of Texas doesn't have the skills to operate these systems. We hired Andy Filong, who built Walmart.com, as our CTO. I'm not kidding. He's an old civil rights guy. He wants to work at this. He does not need money. At this stage in his life, he wants to work on making sure that poor kids have opportunity. So we have Andy Filong as the CTO. We have a group of three faculty at MIT doing data analytics. And we know things, there's stuff here that is 100 PhDs in psychology. We know there are items that no matter whether students get it right or wrong, they try later and harder items after it. And there are other items that whether they get it right or wrong, they don't choose another item, they turn the machine off. We've shown this to the leading motivation theorists in the U.S. They have no clue. They can have a whole research program around this. We have contingency matrix data. We have data about student pauses, all kinds of stuff. So this is a research goldmine. Right? And it needs to be used. We're trying to work with other companies to build common public data sets that can be used. Companies are a little skittish about that. but in real technology companies, there's a lot of cross-investment in each other's work. It's not the high school version of capitalism. These companies invest in each other's technologies, and they have agreements sharing key data sets. Semitech in Austin was an example of that. So we're very interested in working with the three or four other people who work at our scale. We're close to the largest data set in the world on this kind of education data. There's one group at Carnegie Mellon that's about our size. This is all buried in our math department, by the way.
Where physically is the data center?
Data center is in 1616 Guadalupe. Nice space where the School of Library Science is. We needed a lot more space than we could get over here. The servers, by the way, are in Silicon Valley and Dallas, Texas. They're backup monster servers to keep all of this stuff. And the truth is, I know very little about that part of the work. And the absolute truth is, I want to know even less than I do know about it. That's just needed to do this kind of work at scale. But I think we can be up to 1 million students. And these are students typically who are not even getting recent editions of textbooks, let alone any kind of technology. The big decision was not to go with teacher replacement. We were urged by industry people to just replace teachers and have kids in front of computers. I just think that's wrong. So much of this, the hard part, is investing in teachers learn this stuff when they teach it. And the challenges, and Mark knows about this, is how do we help teachers learn mathematics in the process of teaching it as teachers, not by being turned into students again? And if you play with this, you'll see the strategies that Kathy and her peers have put together, what we call respectful support systems for teachers. Your ideas about inverse functions, we've had major arguments about that behind the scenes, about what's the right way to do it. And then we looked at how do students visualize the derivative of inverses when they get to calculus? Where is inverse going to reappear, and which of these model images should we put in for later work? And it's
I'm just teaching some little kids, and they know about real value functions because they do some stuff. But when you talk about sets and functions between sets, that they get way easier. I mean, it's a simple little thing, and it really is. So I think I just happen to think. Those kids are in sixth grade. They understand inverse functions.
So one of the design questions is, at what level of abstraction should one introduce topics? And this is very controversial, but I actually was an advocate for starting with...
lots of abstraction.
Yeah, in this particular case, not in every case. So this is the work. This is the Dana Center. And I did my last little advertisement. Since I came here, our department has gotten much more competitive. The department is much stronger than it was when I came here by any standard. And one of the things that makes it strong is it's not just strong in traditional areas of mathematics, but the computational side is incredibly strong. The application side is getting stronger. Now that the campus is hired, Lauren Myers, is it? We're going to get stronger in that area, and there's no math department that has anything approaching this level of educational sophistication. And it's very hard to move up in rankings. You can move up from 15th to 13th, maybe. But I really think our department should define itself in terms of its breadth and not be defined just by the way other people evaluate existing departments. We have an unusual combination of strengths in this department. And I think that if we promoted that, it would generate far more resources for all the work that takes place in it. Advertisement completed. Thank you. Anyone who wants to visit can come by and we'll show you the work.
Well, I should say, thank you to Ted. There is now a link from the department's website to the
All right.